Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I dreamed a dream of days to come where sponsorship is high and money is forthcoming.
That's beautiful, Kevin.
No, I really added a voice onto that one, too. I really was trying to go for something there.
Listeners, we love creating this podcast, but it does cost money. Please don't make me sell my Angel record.
Oh, my gosh. The original cast recording of Angel.
That, like, nobody has.
Nobody has it.
If you like what we are doing and want us to keep doing more of it, please head over to patreon.com.
What?
PATREON.com.
Patreon.
Patreon.
Yeah,
Patreon.
Rion.
Patreon.
Yeah, and once you're there, search for Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends. And of course, we don't expect to give without receiving some great rewards.
Such rewards include behind-the-scenes videos, shout-outs on future episodes, or episodes, depending on what part of the country you're from, because I said episodes, and early access to some of our podcasts. Hell, for the right price, Kevin and I will come to your apartment and act out all of Agnes of God.
So head over, friends, to patreon.com to help us out.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at Broadway Curtain. And
on Instagram, we are Broadway Curtain Podcast.
We're not as hip as the young kids, so we're very excited that we actually could remember some of those social media handles right now. We are both very excited because today we have with us a returning guest, returning now, which was going to be for his fourth interview. And it really is.
It's Richard.
And blabbermouth.
No, and this actually came at Richard's request. We told Richard we'd love to have him back anytime, and Richard took us up on it, which I love.
Yeah.
We are so honored to have with us once again the amazing Richard Maltby Jr.
Hello, both of you.
Welcome
Hello
back.
Again, Richard. The last interviews that we had with you were just really fantastic and eye-opening, and it was such a great look into the artistic process, both as a director and as a lyricist. And we're going to continue that discussion today and focusing specifically on a musical that is returning to Broadway.
That's right.
In its first major revival, which we're all very excited about. And that show is Miss Saigon.
Indeed it is.
It playing, I think it was my first Broadway musical that I ever saw.
Was it really?
Yeah, really. Yeah, we didn't talk about that last time, but I was like 14 or 15, and my grandparents lived here, and they were very supportive of the arts. They loved the arts, and they knew that I had an interest, and so they immediately bought one ticket for me to see it in the orchestra, and I saw it, and I was completely rocked by it, completely blown away.
I hear these stories. I mean, people Miss Saigon was their first musical, people for whom Big was their first musical, people for whom Ain't Misbehavin' was their first musical. Seem to be entirely made up of people who lost their virginity.
Wait, that's right.
One of our musicals.
Thanks, Richard.
Well, I hope you did. Yes. Hope it was successful.
It was. It was. Hey, still doing
here.
It.
It did it. It obviously did what it's supposed to do.
That is right.
The first musical really does change your life. You look and see at what a Broadway show is, and if you are responsive in any way to that, you never go back. I mean, if you look at it and go, oh, yeah, I might rather see a movie. That's not our guy. You're not our person.
Exactly.
Do you remember what your first musical was that made you feel that way?
The first musical I ever saw was Carousel. I was about 8 or 9.
Wow.
And all I wanted was for the Carousel to come back. So I kept saying to my mother, when's the Carousel come back? When's the Carousel? She kept saying, shh, next scene. Well, the next scene after the Carousel scene is the 25-minute, the longest scene in musical,
Right, and the bench scene.
Set never changed. And then finally the scene ended and the scenery changed and the Carousel wasn't there. And as you know, the Carousel never does come back. So that was my memory.
Did you have that way with the helicopter? Were you like, is the helicopter?
When's the helicopter come back? When's
the helicopter come back? Doesn't enter until the middle of the second act.
Yeah. I know. It gives
the Carousel is right there at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
So now tell us, how did the idea of Miss Saigon first come about? And what year was that? We're going to go back.
Ooh, well, it was probably 1986, 85.
Oh.
The Claude Michel and Alain Boublil had finished Les Mis. It was in the process of moving from the Barbican Center, I guess, to the West End. It was sort of up and running, and enough for them to start thinking about what their next show would be.
Uh-huh.
And I guess that process took them quite a long time. I guess in the back of their mind was using an opera plot of some sort, and I guess maybe a La Boheme was in there somewhere. I'm sure not La Boheme, Madame Butterfly was in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And Claude Michel saw a photograph in a newspaper. This is a well-known story.
Yes, it is.
And it showed a Vietnamese woman giving her child that she had by an American soldier to soldiers to take the child to America so that he would have a better life than she would give. And the look on her face was heartbreaking. And Claude Michel said, that has to be the most incredible emotional experience that anybody could go through. That should be the centerpiece of the show. That led them back to Madame Butterfly, which is, an American Navy man who meets a geisha in Japan, and she has a baby. And they started on that, taking all of the material from the reality of Vietnam. I mean, they thought of moving it to Vietnam, which made perfect sense because
timely.
We're now, just about 10 years after.
Yeah.
The fall of Saigon, and they followed through on that, and they have a policy, that they do a first draft for themselves, and they don't show it to anybody. Mm. So they did the whole first act, which they laid out. They had a structure for the second act, but they did the first act and then showed it to Cameron. And I guess this was Les Mis was running in London, but had not moved to the United States. It was
gotcha.
It's in that period.
Yeah.
And Cameron really, really loved it, but he was convinced that this show needed an American writer, not a British writer.
Right.
Needed someone who could bring an American sensibility to it, because not only was the hero American, but the American presence in Vietnam
was.
And he wasn't sure that Europeans would be able to capture it. He was exactly right.
And they write their first draft in French, right?
Write the first draft in French. So I had just done. Song and dance.
Yeah.
For Cameron so he set up a meeting and I met them and then received a draft, which was a literal translation of the French.
A
literal translation of the French, and a tape of Claude Michel singing the entire first act and playing the score. So here's Claude Michel's voice alone singing everything in French. So I'm hearing, I didn't know what it was. Every now and then the recitatives would be interrupted by a really pretty melody, but I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
I followed it. And I hadn't seen Les Mis, so I just didn't know what they were doing. So I said, thank you, Cameron. I don't want to do this.
Really? I mean, that was...
That was it. And also, it was now mid-80s. And in the 10 years since the end of the Vietnam War, no work, movie, television show, novel... Nothing was successful. The America simply did not want to look at the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Just let it be. Yeah.
And so that was certainly another reason to not get excited about doing a show set in Vietnam. So time went by, and two things happened. One is I saw Les Mis in Washington and sort of went, oh, I get it. Mm. I get what that stuff is. I get what recitative is, because, of course, musicals don't have recitative.
No, not the way opera does.
Even the sung through Andrew Lloyd Webber shows, all the plot is subsumed in the songs.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
They don't have recitatives. They don't have any of the middle sort of talky sections. And so I suddenly got what they were doing. And then Platoon opened and won the Academy Award. So suddenly it seemed like we could look at America would look at the Vietnam War again. And so I called Cameron and said, you know, remember that show?
right.
Have you, picked anybody else? And he said, no, we were waiting for you, Richard. I don't think it was true at all, but I think he just was waiting for them to write the second act. But
that's great.
But I was, suitably flattered and asked to be considered again. And then by that time, they had just finished the second act, another tape from Claude Michel. But yes, now at least I had a sense of what it was about.
There's and
and I met them, and they're really endearing. They did not want to know about my artistic interests at all. They want to know about my sex life. That was all.
Well,
they were French. They want to know who I was living with, and how good it was.
You see, that's a great way to start off a production meeting.
Like a
I
fun
think.
Party, yeah.
It's a fun
party.
I want to work on that.
It was they're really delightful people. I mean, they're very serious. I mean, very they take themselves very seriously.
Yeah.
But they were riding on one of the most gigantic hits of all time.
They must have been really on a high after Les Mis. Oh,
so,
indeed,
they were a little full of themselves. But I must say, the moment that we went into work, all that went away. It was just about the work. They were the most professional, dedicated. I mean, it was just about writing the show.
Writing a good show.
I wanted to ask you a question, which was, would you consider yourself to be a political person? Did your opinions of the Vietnam War in any way shape or filter what you were then putting down on the page?
I'm not a particularly a political person. I've sort of become one in the last 5 years out of terror. I think everybody has done that. But I didn't read the newspapers terribly much, and I thought the world was going to take care of itself, and as it always seemed to do, and. But it was true. Cameron's instinct to have an American was exactly right, because it became clear that the Europeans on the show, and Alana is French, Italian, Algerian, and Claude Michel is from Vienna, and Cameron, of course, is British, but they really didn't understand the devastation of the failure of the Vietnam War. It was far more than that. We lost the war. It actually destroyed our American mythology.
Yeah. Mm.
We are the good guys. John Wayne comes over the hill and saves the day, and we win.
Yeah.
That's America's fantasy, and we do good things for other people.
Yeah.
Well, we were the bad guys. John Wayne didn't come over the hill, and we lost.
Right.
And with it came all these, stories of atrocities and the fantasy that we had of ourselves was destroyed. That I knew. They didn't know that. I mean, the French, the English, you've been losing colonies for 100 years. Get over it. It's like, so
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I don't think that they understood you know, that other quite ephemeral quality, which I was able to sort of articulate, and which they then incorporated into the show. I mean, the show is not a political show, you know, but there is certainly the element of America's misguided. I mean, America is, Chris is America, son of a dodo, but is good-hearted, wants to do the right thing.
Yeah, well-intentioned.
Totally well-intentioned. We are, as a, that's what we are. Mm. We are good-hearted. We want to take care of things. We want to make things right for people. We want to give them our philosophy and our democracy and everything. And then we go in with our big club feet and
muck it up.
And, yeah, and do it all wrong. But the impulse, you know, that sort of Central American impulse was there. And and of course it led eventually to the addition of the show, which is the breakdown, Chris's breakdown in the second act, where he's, you know, so I wanted to help her protect her. Christ, I'm an American. How could I fail to do good?
Yeah,
which I think would never have been in the show if we hadn't started talking that way. And it's the only political line in the show,
but it carries such weight, and it doesn't club you over the head with it. It's not a political statement.
Thinly veiled, but yet very there.
Yeah, because I'm thinking if there were musicals after, or they were reacting to the Vietnam War, they were usually very angry musicals. They were protest musicals. I feel, and so this one has a nice big beating heart, and I think you get more, you know, flies with honey than you do vinegar. When you, if now, please forgive me if I'm incorrect on this. The Puccini opera is based on a Belasco play. Is that correct?
It's based on a French novel called Madame Chrysanthemum, which then became a Belasco play called Madame Butterfly, which became Puccini's opera Madame Butterfly. And I think, you know, Butterfly has fewer syllables than chrysanthemum, I guess. So it has quite a tradition, and we went back to the Pierre Loti novel. We actually never looked at the Belasco play.
Oh interesting.
We did look at the. We of course, you know, dealt with it with the opera, but the opera has one gigantic sort of flaw in it, dramatically, and that is that Pinkerton is a shit.
He doesn't
care about her, and doesn't really care about the baby, and doesn't, you know, and his wife is kind of along for the ride. So we have a tragic woman who fell in love and has a baby with somebody who doesn't deserve her, and pretty much that was still present in the draft that I got. It was Chris, who at that time was called Trevor.
How are you doing there, Trevor?
they named everybody people from Les Mis. I mean, they were going to change the names.
Okay.
Placeholders.
Trevor Nunn.
So it was Trevor Nunn. I mean, the idea that this sort of redneck guy from the South would be named Trevor was hysterical. But anyway, what was the point I was making?
The source material.
In that draft, Chris basically did the same thing that he does in the opera, which we talked a lot about. I mean, that was a real shortcoming.
Yeah.
And then out of the discussions came the realization that was really terrific, because the moment that the war ended, Vietnam totally closed down to the West. Mm-hmm. There were no visitors. There was no diplomatic connection. So if the two lovers were separated, there'd be no way for him to get. I mean, Pinkerton could go back anytime and go and get her and bring her out if he wanted, if he was in love with her. But because of that, they could actually fall in love. They could actually be in love and separated totally. And he he could even try for years, several years, to try to get word to her, try to get through, and finally give up because, of course, the chance of seeing her again was nil. Mm. And that allowed us to have a real love story instead of a story of a woman who fell in love with somebody who didn't deserve her. So once that happened, then we had – and the falling in love in the last days of the war just before the fall of Saigon and all of that suddenly started to make enormous sense. Suddenly the we were talking about it. I mean, always remember that photograph. Everything came from that photograph. This woman, this mother giving her child to American soldiers to take to the American soldier who is the child's father so that he will have a better life than he would have in Vietnam. That would only really work if the man were deserved it. if the man loved her. And then what's really great is that, of course, then he's already married someone else. She doesn't know what to do with it. What's great about the story is it's a tragedy with no villains. It's just the life led to this until the point where the woman, where Kim, our heroine, kills herself so that she forces the child into this new life.
Was that always the option? I mean, did you know that that was how it was going to end the whole time? That we would have that sacrifice?
I mean, she could have simply given the child away, but it's just not quite as dramatic. And also, then she'd always be there as an option. She was smart enough to see the whole picture and realize that the only way to make this happen, so that the child would have the life she wanted the child to have, was to eliminate herself from the picture.
That's epic.
It is.
I'm curious about the writing, you know, the collaboration process with when you guys were all in the room together. A couple of things. Was Cameron there a lot? Did he have a lot of input? And then were you literally translating the lyrics to English? So you wrote all of the English lyrics?
No, it wasn't a translation. And Cameron was not around. It was just the three of us, and really it was just Alain and me. What Alain did, it was his pattern was he would go to a hotel someplace. He loved this particular hotel in Brittany. We went there a couple. We'd go there for like 2 weeks. So we would go to a hotel. Oh, God, it's not so terrible. I mean, the south
probably
of France,
a nice hotel,
Brittany,
yeah.
And out in the countryside in England. I mean, it was not painful. we would go there for 2 weeks. And at the end of 2 weeks, we would have half the first act, the other half of the first act, or the second act. We would do that. I'd type it up, and then it would and we'd send it off, and then sort of forget it for a while everybody digested it until we got together and then did the next thing. So we would do it in 2 week clumps. And what we did was, Alana and Claude Michel had laid out the story, the plot, and the structure of the show in terms of scenes, and that was brilliant, including moving the fall of Saigon to the middle of the second act, which was daring. I mean, you get halfway through you get the story going, then skip 3 years, and then pick up the story, the missing part of the story in the second act. That was stunning, and that they had done. But within that, the dramaturgy of the scenes was pretty rudimentary. So what we did with the music pre-existing, with the music being laid out, Alain and I wrote a play, basically, to that music. And while we used the ideas that were there in French often, but often we didn't. Often we broke it up into, explored a little more deeply what was going on in the scenes, so that there was more more character work and more background. We knew so much more about the characters, so we had to tell an enormous amount of backstory. We had to know where Chris came from.
All in music,
there.
Too. Like, there's this is all listeners know this, but it's sung through. There's no dialogue.
There's no dialogue, and it is not only was it sung through, but it was pre-existing.
Yeah,
I mean, even the recitatives and the modulations when something, you know, when an emotional moment happens, it happens in the music. That pre-existed. There is a real argument to be made for Claude Michel being the central dramatist of the show, because that score existed almost intact in terms of how we moved from this moment to the next moment, how the transitions went, what the scene was, much if it was a dialogue scene, it was this kind of rhythm and that kind of rhythm and this kind of rhythm. Those things all pre-existed, but they didn't have a whole lot of complexity to them, and they didn't have a great deal of character, and they didn't have specifics of character. Mm. They had laid it out without going into a lot of detail, and so we constructed the backstory of Kim and how her family, had been destroyed in a napalm attack on the village that she was in, and why was she there, and what hope did she have, and where was Chris from, what background did he come from, why was he in Vietnam? What job did he have? He wasn't a combat soldier. He was one of those people, and we made him a driver for the embassy.
Right.
And those guys were. The Second World War was notable for having the most intelligent soldiers that ever were in any war, because it was college graduates and high school graduates and PhDs and if a leader of a group got killed, there were 10 other people who could take over who were smart enough. The Vietnam War was not. It was a almost entirely a drafted war. College kids sort of got out of it. There were lots and lots of sort of rednecks and young guys who were not terribly educated, hadn't finished high school or had just barely finished high school. A lot of people from the South, a lot of people from areas that were not, terribly sophisticated, and also that had all sorts of racial overtones. And the funny thing, and that's why it's really great that we decided to make John an African American, because the war was the kind of place where a redneck from the South would become best friends with a man he wouldn't even speak to in the United States. And that was part of the anomaly of the war. So the more we went into the specifics, the richer the characters got, the richer the scenes got, and then we addressed the storytelling. We had to sort of tell about what happened what was going on in Saigon, that sense, of the impending doom. I mean, the city was surrounded, and the surround was getting closer and closer, and people were getting nervous. But that John Wayne image was absolutely there, something was going to come along and save the day, because something always does. Everyone believed somewhere in there that something was going to happen and they were going to pull it off.
We can't lose.
Yeah, we can't lose. We don't lose. We can't lose. Oh, my God. I think we're...
This is it.
We got to get out of here.
Sounds like
God.
The election.
Even getting on the helicopters to evacuate out to the ships was terrifying. And we, you know, had the last... so we're about the last helicopter out, which is why the helicopter is no stunt.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
No, yeah. No.
It's an actual necessity. It's about the last helicopter.
What a coup in theater, too. I mean, to do that at that time period.
Oh, the reality of it is slightly better, and I was really kind of hoping we'd find a way of doing it. They actually, the last group were in the compound, the plane, the helicopter landed on a helipad that was above the building. They went into the building, the last soldiers, and barricaded the doors. The crowd broke down the gates, came into the yard, and started to go break through the barriers and follow them up. The last group of soldiers on the roof were getting in. The people were there was a trap door that had glass on it, and the Vietnamese came through and bashed through it with their hands, and the soldiers took their hands and went around and ripped it against the broken glass so that they would go back. They got in the helicopter. The crowd was now filled. The embassy was now filled with people, and they threw tear gas down into the yard. The last soldier got into the helicopter. The helicopter took off. And the rotors of the helicopter sucked the tear gas up into the helicopter, so the last helicopter leaving Vietnam flew out blind. It's the most... unfortunately, we couldn't do that on the stage.
Wow.
But it was...
I don't think the helicopter is a stunt. I think it's such a moving part of the entire story.
Oh,
I don't think
yeah.
you can do
no,
it.
No, I mean
that.
we were sort of lumped together with the Phantoms, Phantom of the Opera's chandelier, some big stage thing.
But this is so dramaturgically important to have it integrated into everything.
Yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Can you describe a day in one of those hotel rooms with Alain? What would a normal day be like in that collaborative process?
Well, we would take whatever the scene was. We would look at the translation of it that Alain had done. We would see what was useful, what was not useful, and we would discuss what the scene was really about. Then we would try to figure out if this is the really what's going on with these characters, then where does that happen in the music? You know, the very opening scene backstage of at the club. When does Kim? Where is she? Is she being brought in? Is she not? Yeah. You know, and interestingly enough, in the original, the engineer came in and after he said some things to the other girls, he said, "And who's that? Why are you wearing that dress? Oh, this is my new princess," he says.
Right.
The way the show opened in London when we opened it. There was an interesting thing that happened. I always think of this as a sort of a significant moment for me, but about 3 months after the show opened, the show was very heavily orchestrated, and the cast members were over-singing. Mm. So they were dropping like flies. They were like getting laryngitis. There were so many people out of the show, and there was some kind of epidemic going on in London that they almost couldn't keep up with that. And so Cameron made the dangerous decision. I mean, to simplify the orchestrations. I mean, whatever it cost, he went in and simplified and thinned out the orchestration so that they were more supportive and could let the singers
sing. Did he hire a different orchestrator or use the same one? William Brock,
yeah. Yeah.
Wow. It's expensive, too.
It is. But I also thought there's something strange. And there is a sound of an engaged audience. And it didn't happen until Kim and Chris were up in the room. But up until that moment, you just sort of sensed that something was missing. It didn't have that. You can sense an audience, a collective intensity, and it didn't happen at the beginning. And I thought a lot about it, and I thought they don't know who matters and who doesn't. At the opening, I had given a lot in order for there to be color, there were lots of lines for different soldiers.
Yeah.
And then Chris and John were talking to the engineer. In the very opening scene, all the other girls were talking, and then we saw Kim. And we didn't know who to watch.
Mm.
It suddenly occurred to me that all information from the stage to the audience is neutral. A minor character, a major character,
yeah.
The scenery, you know, the props, everything comes with absolute equal intensity, unless you give them.
Right.
That's why I said
the director in you.
That's why God made follow spots, because the person who comes in a follow spot is the person you're supposed to look at.
Yeah. I mean,
that's actually what happens.
Wow.
So we looked back at that, took out a lot of the lines that went for secondary characters, started with her on the street. The first image is the girl. The engineer sees her and takes her into the club, walks into the club and says, "I found this girl. Get her dressed. You know, give her a dress because she's going on. She's probably a virgin. She'll be worth more money." So we know instantaneously that's the girl who matters. And when we get to the club, it changed to something that I thought was so bald that it was absolutely embarrassing, I thought. But the very first line is the engineer says, "Oh, Mr. Chris, Mr. John, you've come to win Miss Saigon," and they say, "Oh, engineer,
yeah."
It's like they announce who they are and why they're there,
right?
And they're the only people who have solo lines. Up until that, it's group singing,
right.
And as soon as we put it into the show, including a restaging of the opening with her in there, and that sound of disengagement went away. Let this be a lesson to everybody in the world. I mean, it absolutely, the audience just needs to know who to watch,
right?
And what the stakes are. And as soon as we did that, this is the story of a girl. There she is, who comes to this club, and she's going to be one of those girls, and she meets these soldiers. Those are the ones. And what they then say, we pay attention to, which is John has said, I'm going to get you laid because it's a last souvenir before we're out of
the
here.
The end is so near.
And Chris says, I don't know, you know, this used to be a lot of fun, and it just isn't anymore. It's, you know, it's all going sour. It's all going south. I don't feel like it. Don't you know that this... this whole adventure in Vietnam is turning bad, and we're gonna, you know, he's like the only one who sort of sees it.
Yeah.
And so suddenly we get all of the context of the story right in the action of the opening scene, and at that moment the audience was with it right from the beginning.
It's amazing. Did you have any desire at some point to ever direct the piece?
No. And I don't think that Cameron would have considered me, but no, I don't think so, because the immensity of the task was all I could do to keep the all of the elements in the story alive and clear. I mean, we have to tell what happened to the engineer in his re-education camps. Yeah. We have to say that in very few words, you know, and preferably with a little joke, you know, which we actually did, you know. Wherever I go, I speak Uncle Ho. I speak Uncle Ho and think Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
That it's a joke, but it tells you that he was being, you know, re-educated, exactly. and they pretended that it had worked, but it didn't. So that was as much as I could do, and Cameron again quite brilliantly chose Nick Heitner, who had never done a big show, but who was the absolute up-and-coming young director. Oh, he was brilliant. He was just stunning, everything that happened. For example, we wrote... Claude Michel had written out the whole Fall of Saigon as a piece of music, the big return to... Sun and Moon, the melodies that went through, the big climax where the helicopter leaves, all of that had been written, along with that melody went da 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 bum ba da da ba da 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 bum bum, which then had to be set. And so we, Alan and I, laid out how the story would go, and we wrote all these. I mean, there are like 7 or 8 scenes in that sequence in different locations, and I was working with Alain, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm trying to figure out. Okay, they're in the room here. How do they get over to there? And how do they get up to the bedroom? And where do they get the thing from?" And he said, "You don't have to do that. That's a director's problem." And I thought, oh, you French, what do you know of the theater, you know, you novice, you. And then about half an hour later, I thought, he's right. It's a director's problem.
I'm not going to worry about it.
So I was sitting there typing. They go into the building. They go up to the second floor. They barricade the doors. What did I care? It's a director's problem. Helicopter comes in. They get up there. And so we just, you know, I said, I don't know how anybody's going to do this. And then he went off with Bob Avian for a weekend and laid out the whole thing with those gates that it was two walls and a pair of gates that were either closed or open open and closed. And when they were closed, the crowd was either on the outside with the soldiers on the inside, or the soldiers were on the inside and the crowd was on the outside. Yeah. And it was just brilliantly laid out with these simple just the devices of the gate that change the location in an instant. But that was all done, as I said, to the music that was already laid out.
And when you guys were in the hotel room, I mean, how did you listen to the music? Do you have a recording?
Had a CD or a tape or something? No, I think it was a tape.
Yeah, it was a tape. Okay. And you were just like...
We would just run through it huh. And play it over and over again.
So, Richard, it's now coming back.
I know.
Broadway, March of...
2017. That's getting really close.
I know.
I just walked by the theater and all the sound equipment's going in.
Yes.
And it's the same theater, too, that it was at before.
It's the same theater. It's... You know, as far as I'm concerned, that's our theater.
Every time.
Yes.
I mean, what's Cinderella doing in that theater? How dare it be there?
How dare she? Get out of there.
Promises go away.
The color purple.
Get out of there.
Give me a break.
The Miss Saigon Theater.
It's the Miss Saigon Theater.
Oh, yeah.
So we're back there, yeah.
Why is it coming back? What was the reason to bring back this story?
Well, Cameron has been bringing back all of his shows, and he's made... this is the Cameron McIntosh production. The Broadway production and the London production were huge, and that was what toured. They were expensive to move. There have been tours. There was a tour that went around the country that was much, much simpler, bus and truck that went around mm-hmm. that lasted eventually for 4 years, was much simpler. Everybody's sort of amazed that this huge, huge show plays when it gets smaller. But the fact of the matter is, on paper, it's two scenes and three scenes.
Yeah. It's a
very, very intimate story.
It is.
With, interrupted by these sort of large set pieces,
right.
Like the Morning of the Dragon and the Fall of Saigon and some of the other things, but it on paper it's a play. Yeah,
the love story is
and
so
everybody
intimate.
Every time it's done, I saw it done in Denmark in a very small theater, and everyone was amazed at how well it played. Well, it plays because the play plays.
Yeah.
And you don't really need all of the spectacle to make it happen. It was given this spectacular production, but. So this is a new version, scaled down a little. You sit in the theater, you won't think that it's scaled down, but it's a simpler physical production. And I have to say, found this young girl who was from America.
Yeah, she's American,
and she was like 17 or 18. She won a high school performing context, you know, there's some
like
the Fred Awards. What is it called?
The Fred Astaire Awards.
And it's something like that. And it's for high school kids. She didn't win. She came in second. But my daughter was there, and saw and said that girl, her, she's gonna be. She will be Kim. And of course she did. I mean, she's an amazing performer. Huh. The cast in London was just terrific. The direction of it is absolutely breathtaking in terms of the emotional intensity of it.
It's not Nick Heitner. It's
Heitner. It's a different director, Lawrence Conner, who did The Les Mis.
That's right.
Did,
yeah.
did
School of Rock. School of Rock too. I think. Yeah. Yeah.
And so,
because some of the pictures I've seen, it still reminds me of the original production.
Oh yeah.
So it's not a completely reinvented production. You said it's the Cameron McIntosh production.
Well,
Bob Avion, I see, is credited still as the musical stager.
The two dance sequences are somewhat similar to the original.
Yeah, if it's already great, why change it?
But. Yeah, well, but it has a definitely different feel than from the original, and I guess I would just say it's redefined for now.
Mm. And does that mean that any of the lyrics or scenes have changed and been altered at all?
There are a few lyric changes that have been made along the way. I didn't make them. I made some of them, but But they considered making a lot more, but then ended up not making them. But the lyric writing in the show is very tricky.
Yes,
To me the thing that I'm proudest about is the thing that nobody notices, because nobody would, and that is that we took basically a European-based score and made it sound like the natural vocabulary of Americans. Mm-hmm. Because we did it, and because it was successful, nobody thinks twice about it. But if you were confronted with just the music and you listened to it, you would think, but this isn't American music. You know, these don't sound like American soldiers, American... I think they were in Claude Michel's mind, but the rhythms, you know, his natural rhythms were not necessarily American. But we dug into the music and found American phrases and American language that had the same rhythms, so that it sounds entirely like an American, a cast of Americans.
Right, vernacular. Yeah,
very true.
I agree. What Cameron McIntosh has, you know, we have so many shows that we can thank him for. Why is he such a great producer? What makes him, you know, so good? Because he is mostly a hands-on producer, isn't he?
Yes.
And it's rare to have name above the title these days.
More so now than he was back then.
Yeah.
Producers are crazy people. They need to be, because you have to have such incredible dedication and focus. And that dedication and focus is not what we mortals have.
Especially in this business.
and Cameron's aberration to me is that if the curtain goes up on a show of his anywhere in the world, and that performance isn't brilliant that night, he dies.
Wow.
It is so much an extension of him. And you could say that's a suitable reason to put someone in an asylum, or you could say that's a brilliant producer. I'm going to go with the letter.
I like that.
Yeah.
But he is.
He is that. He's he's charming and he's lots of fun and he loves parties and all that stuff. Yes. But his love of a truly dramatized musical event is so deep. He will do anything to make that happen. And I guess he's open to other ideas. He's open to invention. He knows that you can't get anywhere by doing what was already done, and so therefore he's receptive to a new idea. I mean, if Andrew says, I've set a bunch of T.S. Eliot songs about cats, and I think maybe it could go on stage, an awful lot of people would say, thank you very much,
that's
Andrew,
crazy.
Goodbye.
Yep.
And Andrew said, yeah. And I mean, Cameron said, yes.
I was going to say, speaking of things that are different, before we went on the air, you were saying that Madame Suzanska, which you're working on now with David Shire, also is different, different from what you think you have done previously.
Well, certainly the score is. I mean, it's so incredibly varied. We have, South African music and Viennese music and London in the 80s music. And, we have the story is about a Polish music teacher who was she escaped the Holocaust and she encounters a 16-year-old piano prodigy from South Africa who, being a classical prodigy, South Africa has no tradition of classical musicians. They have a huge musical tradition of jazz, mm-hmm. but not classical music. And So he's a kind of an exile as well. And this boy changes her life and she changes his. And it's really about, I mean, among other, it has reverberations that are so incredibly timely because it's all about exiles and people, national identity, and who are you if you're somewhere else
right.
other than the
yeah.
place where you were born? And who do you become? Who are you as an artist? Who are you to, you know?
Yeah.
What does it mean to be an artist? And where does music come from? Mm-hmm. And music seems to be the one thing that breaks through all barriers.
Right. Common language.
So it's very, I mean, every time you read another headline about immigrants and all that, you know, the reverberations got even bigger on this show.
Well,
It's
in Toronto in rehearsal.
We just had our sits probe yesterday, and we will be on stage until we start in February 25th with an audience, and then we run for 4 weeks until we open, and then we just play a couple more weeks, and then we have to vacate the theater because the opera company is coming in. And then
which theater are you playing in?
The Elgin Theater.
Oh, the Elgin. Nice.
It's beautiful.
The Elgin.
Gorgeous,
yeah, very
gorgeous,
nice theater.
gorgeous theater. And then we'll probably come back and, you know, see what happens after that.
And you flew in today. Not, I would like to say for us, but I know that that's not true. But the fact that we get to have you for today is really
you could be
truly
home.
A pleasure.
You could be relaxing for a moment.
That's totally true.
Doing a crossword puzzle.
Yes.
But we really, really, really appreciate getting to have this time with you and talking about Miss Saigon and your future musical. We can't wait to see it.
Neither can I.
God. And I hope when it comes down here, you'll join us again and talk more about that process.
Sure. Shows are living things, and they the only thing I know is that you're always a beginner, and every show you think, oh, I can use the knowledge I gained on the last show in this show. And the first thing that goes out the window is the knowledge you gained on the last show. You know, the only thing that you kind of gain from experience is the knowledge that if you keep at it, you will solve it. But the solution is not necessarily anything that you already have in your back pocket. Yeah. It's something that you can very, very seldom use your old tricks, you know. And God knows I would love to do that all the time.
Right.
But every show has its own rules, and this one is, we break up timeline and storyline. I mean, it jumps around in time and location. And it's very powerful. It's got Vicky Clark.
Yeah.
It has Montego Glover. It has Judy Kay. How bad could this be?
Exactly. That's why we have to see
it. No, they're absolutely breathtaking.
Oh,
Judy.
That's wonderful.
Vicky Clark gives a performance. I've never seen anything like it. So
we cannot wait.
Yeah.
We cannot wait. Maybe we'll travel up to Canada to take a look. Richard, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
Letting us pick your brain.
Yeah. Always happy to chat.
Thank you.
Press the button and I talk.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.